Everybody, welcome back to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State and beyond. Today, we're here with Maria Blights, a graduate research assistant at Oklahoma State University. How are you doing today, Maria?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here, Derek.
Yeah, of course. So do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of how you got into birds and what led you to being a graduate student at Oklahoma State University?
I can, and I'll keep it moderate length. I won't do the long version, but I got a bachelor's in biology from Calvin University in Michigan, and I knew I wanted to work outside, but I didn't really know exactly where. It happened that when the pandemic hit and everything was shut down, I was living at home with my parents in the year 2020, and I found a volunteer position at a spring migration station in South Michigan called Michigan State Bird Observatory. And they needed volunteers, and because I, had no job or school, I was able to donate 5 days a week to mist netting migrants coming through that region. And it was there that I met other birders for the first time, and birders my own age, and as where I realized that the wildlife biology field is a career that people can go into, and people that were similar to me were doing that kind of thing. So from there, I started doing birding trips on my own, and I ended up getting a job in California monitoring shorebirds. And that was the start of a 3-year journey doing different seasonal contract positions across the United States, working low pay, many hours, but doing a lot of fun travel and seeing a lot of great birds. And eventually I decided I wanted to get a graduate degree and apply to a position. And here I am in Oklahoma.
So, would you kind of credit getting into birding because of the pandemic?
Yes. And that was a realization I had recently, that maybe if the pandemic hadn't happened, I wouldn't really be where I am today, which is a weird thought. I had even worked with birds before that migration station in Michigan, but it hadn't clicked at the time. So, yeah.
I feel like that's one of the one of the main positive things we got is there's been a lot of birders and people appreciating the outdoors more because of COVID. You know, they couldn't do anything else. And they're like, oh, it's cardinal out my window. That's kind of cool. Let me learn more about that. And then they got into birding. So I feel like that was one of the main positive things is people got more acquainted with the outdoors. So it's kind of cool to see some positives come out of it. What was it like doing the banding 5 days a week? Because that's full-time work basically as a volunteer.
Yeah, it was easy because I didn't have a job at the time, relatively easy. But the station was 90 minutes from my house, so it took a long time to get there and get back. And it was early mornings, opening up mist nets in the dark, and running them for 7 or 8 hours a day, constantly extracting birds to process and band them. And it was difficult for sure. It requires some, dexterity in order to be able to extract them from those nets, and definitely was scary the first time you're holding a bird in your hand and thinking about how fragile they are. But really, they're, I don't know, stronger than you'd expect.
What was the worst bite that you got from a species? I've heard one in particular has a really bad bite because, as much as you are careful with them, they are going to be mad at you. And was there anything that really just surprised you having birds in the hand?
Yes. The fact that they're strong is, one surprise. The worst bite was rose-breasted grosbeak, for
Oh.
sure, in part because they just seem to like scrape away at the skin until there's nothing left. Other things that surprised me about holding birds in hand. I mean, I was just so new to bird. I wasn't a birder at the time, so seeing molt up close, looking at wax wings and realizing that there really is a waxy substance on their wings. I feel like I could come up with other examples, but off the top of my head, yeah.
Yeah, the one I heard the bite really hurts is the cardinal. So grosbeak would kind of fit in with that, but yeah, I've heard cardinal is pretty brutal. Did you get licensed to be a professional bander?
That experience, I was not permitted to band. I was just a extractor. My next job, which was monitoring shorebirds in California, there I was sub-permitted to band shorebirds, and I learned how to band chicks, young plovers, and I banded them with metal bands and plastic bands. And it was another somewhat stressful experience because they're so fragile. And those chicks, they are actually very fragile. So But yeah, it was a great experience.
I think they're some of the cutest. Which
Oh
species
yeah.
in particular were you banding?
We were working with Western snowy plover, the
Yeah,
subspecies of,
adorable.
yeah. I'll show you my sticker. I got this sticker from that job of the chicks,
Oh,
and
very nice.
just very cute.
Yeah, it's so funny because in Louisiana they did work banding the Wilson's plover chicks and also common nighthawk chicks, which look absolutely ridiculous. My friend Katie, she had someone work with her and she nicknamed them, or he nicknamed them floof goblins. And it really is a perfect description of the common nighthawk chicks. But it was so funny with the Wilson's plover chicks because they just look like little cotton balls running around. And you're like, what is this going on? And then you're like, oh my gosh, it's adorable.
Yeah, the term my boss used was a cotton ball on two toothpicks and just
Yep.
running around the beach.
That sounds about right. So with your work out there, did you guys have any interesting findings or anything that you learned in particular from that job with the shorebirds?
Yeah, I learned a lot from that job. I was working that job for 2 years, 2 summers, and where I was working was the Coronado Naval Base. So it's an active Navy training site, but because it's not open to the public, it's great habitat for Western snowy plovers, because they can't be around people with their families and their dogs on beaches. And it was just crazy to see the interaction between like these tiny cotton balls on toothpicks running around the beach and then like tanks rolling by, and it was easy to dislike the Navy because they're threatening these species, and there were some deaths that occurred due to the training. But the truth is that without the Navy, this would be a public beach and there would be zero plovers nesting here. So that was a realization I had over the span of 2 years. Kind of interesting.
Was part of it like flagging nests and kind of just being like, hey, there's a plover nest here, don't put your tank over it kind of deal?
Yeah, I was mostly monitoring. I did some intervention when possible. So if a Navy coordinator asked me, hey, can we enter this area? I'd say, yes, this one's allowed, this one's not. But it's their property, and they would get fined if they didn't follow some protections. But in the moment, there's nothing I can really do to stop them. So I marked nests. I informed where I could, but we weren't, saving every bird.
Yeah, but I mean, at least there is some level of, protection for those that they do have to follow protocol and that there is
Yeah.
at least an associated fine with it. But tell me a little bit more about the work you're doing now for your master's.
Yeah. So I'm getting my master's, and my thesis comes in two parts, but it's all focused on shorebird migration and then how is migration changing in the scope of climate change. The first chapter focuses on some movement data of willets, Western willet, and all the tagging and fun part of that work was done by people before I joined the project. So I'm here for the data side, and I am determining things like how many stopovers do willets take when they're migrating between their winter and their summer grounds? What are the characteristics of those stopover sites? And I'm also looking at how does weather affect how long they're staying at those stopover sites, or does it even affect that at all? The second part of my thesis is more on looking at the quality and availability of forage at these stopover sites. And I'm doing that by sampling some wetlands in Oklahoma for invertebrates. So I'm going to visit some places that are good potential shorebird habitat. We don't know for sure if willets or any shorebirds have visited there specifically, but they're supposed to represent these places that other shorebirds have been. And I'll be taking core samples and sweep net samples and doing a lot of identification and counting, and we'll see what kind of what findings we get. The idea with the invertebrate analysis is that we're comparing these small isolated wetlands to larger lakes that have exposed mud in times of drought, because we think that with climate change and as droughts become more severe and more frequent, shorebirds might be forced away from these small wetlands and forced to forage on these mudflats and lakes instead. And no one's ever really compared lakes to small wetlands. So that's what my work is.
Okay, interesting. Are you pro Eastern Western Willet split then?
I definitely do not feel qualified to speak on that. But the case I heard was if you can't separate them by call, it's probably not a useful split, right?
It's kind of a contentious topic. Like, people feel very passionately about splitting certain species or not. And I feel like that's one that a lot of people are like, it's time, we should split them. So that's always an interesting thing to ask. So you've done some birding in Michigan, I'm assuming, outside of the banding, right? And then California and then Oklahoma. How are those communities similar to Burden? How is it kind of different?
Yeah, I still call myself a pretty casual birder, so I don't know how well I could describe the most passionate birding communities in each of those places. I will say that California has a clear advantage with everything. I think San Diego County was like the most biodiverse county in the United States by some measure. So the birders there are pretty spoiled with rarities and everything. And I dabbled in that a little bit. In Michigan, it's a slower pace for sure. I did a Christmas bird count in Oklahoma, and then I did one in Michigan back to back this past holiday season. And the Oklahoma one, I think we got 60, maybe 70 species even. And then in Michigan, we like just got to 40, you know? So slower pace, but it's my home. So
which one did you like better?
Which count did I like better?
CBC wise, yeah.
Well, it was cold in Michigan, and I don't love the cold, so I don't know if that's the right thing to determine that by, but yeah.
To go in Oklahoma on that one?
Yeah, I guess I'd go with Oklahoma for that reason.
Yeah.
Although the people I went birding with, they wanted to go owling, and they said, let's start at 3:30 in the morning. And I thought, really? We did it. And then we didn't hear any owls until like 5:30 in the morning. So
oh, that's brutal.
Yeah, that was a bad call. But
were you like, guys, what are we doing?
Yeah, why are we out here?
Yeah. So I'm curious kind of your take, getting into birding fairly recently. What do you think about the people that do kind of the crazy things, like the global big ears or the, you know, going owling at 3:30 kind of crowd? Do you see them as crazy, or do you kind of understand? You're like, I kind of get it now. How is your transition into being kind of an outside observer of birders to now being like one of them? And do you think you'll ever get to that crazy stage?
Yeah. Just yesterday, I was talking with my friend, and he said, oh, I'm ranked so-and-so in the county. And I thought, what am I ranked in the county? And I looked it up, and I'm like 77 or something. I got this competitive urge in me. I was like, suddenly wanted to bump that number up. And so that's evidence as I do get the people who do the big ears and the crazy competitive and driving 7 hours to see one species. So I get it. But even so, I probably will never get to that level. I'm just a slower paced birder.
Well, I feel like we need, you know, the bird researchers too. So it's an important role. Even if you never get global big year level, it's good to have the bird research. So you were telling me you recently went down to Texas as well to bird, which I feel like is one of the coolest places. Me and Ryan love going to Texas. And it was your first time there. What was your first impression of being in a place where birding is more part of the almost the infrastructure, you know, the ecotourism industry?
Yeah. I was impressed just by the number of like refuges and parks that we could get to within a 1 hour drive of our Airbnb. It's clearly different down there. And yeah, amazing birds for sure. I don't know what I can say that other people who know the region don't already know. Did that answer your question?
A little bit. To me, it's just always striking because you go down there and you go to the nature center and people are like, oh yeah, this was seen like 5 minutes ago, or like this was seen this other day. And if I go to the nature center, you know, in Wisconsin, people aren't going to know the up to the minute rarities. So it feels like it's just so much more. They're used to birders coming through and they have, you know, welcome birder signs and stuff. And it's almost ingrained into the, you know, the area. And it must bring in a substantial amount of money, the tourism, where I feel like in Midwest states, like, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan, we don't really see that as much. So I feel like every time I go to Texas, I appreciate that it's kind of just part of the community more so than in some of the other states.
Yeah, I can totally agree. I do remember when we went to South Padre Island, we walk up to the visitor center and someone walks out the doors and like intercepts us before we're even in the building. And they're telling us about their alligators, what's been seen today, what hasn't. Yeah, you don't see that in other places.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then, so South Texas is a big one. Southeast Arizona, if you haven't been yet, that's definitely one you should put on your list to go to.
It's on my list.
Yeah, I thought so. You don't like the cold, but Saxon Bog in Minnesota is a really cool place to go in winter if you want to see like Northern Hawk Owl, Great Gray Owl. The Pacific Northwest is really cool. Probably the California area kind of covered that section, but
Somewhat.
that's
I
a
was, South California, so
gotcha. So
I
maybe
definitely home.
check out the North. Really cool area. South Florida, I think, is another really big one. But
For sure.
there's a lot to get into. Is there a place aside from some of those US hotspots that is kind of a dream birding destination for you? Like, say Oklahoma State was going to pay for you to go and take a trip somewhere. What would be your top couple ones on your list?
Oh man, I've been kind of spoiled by seasonal jobs where I really like being in one place for months at a time, so that I see a lot. So I don't like plan a lot of trips in my head, but I've definitely got, most of Central America on my list that I want to go to. Yeah. Costa Rica is a place I've heard a lot of great things about. I actually at one point in my life I lived in Honduras. I did a study abroad there. But I wasn't a birder at the time, so I do want to go back there and get everything I missed.
Yeah, it is tough when you look back in retrospect when you were in a perfect birding place, but you weren't like it wasn't really on your radar, and you're like, man, I could have seen so many things, or you remember like one of the cool ones. But I had that when I went to Jamaica. I remember seeing the streamer-tail hummingbird because it was kind of like an ecology trip, and so they talked about everything. But I remember seeing that one, but I'm sure there was a bunch of other cool stuff that I didn't remember, seeing at the time. So I feel like that's a place that I need to go back to someday. Is there any other place that you're like, gotta go back again? South Texas on your list?
South Texas for sure. I've become a more intense birder just bit by bit, even though I'm not that intense. So I do want to go back to San Diego and maybe do a little more chasing than I did when I lived there. I also went to Guatemala on that same trip and didn't do any birding there. So that's on my list as well. Yeah.
Cool. What was your main passions before you kind of got into the birding stuff?
That's a good question. Do I even remember the time before birding? I was a pretty introverted kid. I did a lot of reading. I was in a book club. I was in marching band. I played clarinet. Did you play any instruments or?
So I play guitar. I was a full-time musician for a little bit, actually. So I still do
Okay.
a couple shows and stuff every once in a while.
Nice. Yeah. I do not play clarinet anymore. That's over now.
If you did combine the clarinet with the birding, you might be able to get like a Snow White moment, out somewhere. I guess depending on your clarinet skills, it could go good or bad.
I could do maybe a wood duck impression, like something like that.
Like it. So, with the Oklahoma birding scene, how's it been just kind of going to the local spots? Because we went and visited our friend Alex, who you know as well. And it was cool just seeing the red clay, the box turtles around the area. What are some of your favorite kind of local things around the campus and just kind of the area by the college?
Yeah, like favorite locations or favorite
Favorite
species?
locations, favorite species. Yeah.
Yeah. I had never been to the Central States before, so coming here I immediately got a bunch of new birds for my life list. I love the Harris's sparrows. They're different from any other sparrow, so that was a really cool one to see. And I saw those at the Botanic Gardens. That's probably the place I go the most often to bird just 'cause it's got great trails. Great stuff. And then I spent a lot of time at Lake Carl Blackwell. I was there just yesterday. And there's a path you can walk to get to the mud flats at the upper end of the reservoir. And a lot of great shorebirds come through there. It's a hot spot. We saw Barred Sandpiper, Avocet, Long-billed Dowitchers. Yeah, it's kind of a intense hike to get out there. A lot of spiders, a lot of ticks, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I think we went out there with Alex. And I think we had painted bunting out there and
Oh,
Mississippi
nice.
kite. Yeah, it's a cool place. And then we really enjoyed going to Gloss Mountain in the Wichita Mountains. Have you checked those out?
Yes, Lost Mountain is on my list of places to go, but I've been to the Wichitas a couple times now, and yeah, they stand out. There's not anywhere in Oklahoma like them.
Yeah, it was really neat being there. And what kind of the main thing that I remember us seeing is the black-capped vireos, because that's a pretty good bird for anywhere, and I feel like that was a solid location to get them.
Yeah. I feel like the other day I was talking to someone from Texas and he was like, "Oh, we get black-capped vireos all the time, but for Oklahoma." It
Yeah, they
was
have them in
exciting.
the hill country with the golden cheek warbler. So I think people will visit that specific area. But I don't know. It's neat that they're in Oklahoma too. And well, I mean, Texas gets all kinds of migrants along the Gulf too. So I think they had like a black-capped vireo on South Padre the other day, as well as like a varied bunting. They're always getting crazy stuff. And I feel like it's been one of the craziest years for South Texas. Oklahoma probably is a little less as far as crazy migrants that you guys are getting, but I'm sure there's some other cool rare stuff that shows up. I remember Alex telling us it was hard to find ducks sometimes. Like you'd go out on the lakes and there'd just be like no waterfowl.
Yeah, the winter is the best time for sure, if you want to see ducks. And some of the lakes out here are, so much of it's private lands that you can only stand in one place, and ducks past a certain point, like you'll never be able to identify them. So.
Yeah, do you feel like the locals are not as nice as in the Midwest?
I honestly have not interacted with a lot of local and landowners out here yet, so I'm hesitant to summarize.
The introvert in
But
you?
yes, the introvert in me. But that does seem to be other people's perceptions, is that people really, they're very territorial about their own land.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the Midwest people are really welcoming, like and really helpful. Like if you meet a birder out, well, I guess birders in general are normally pretty helpful. Sometimes if you run into photographers, I feel like they're a little more short and they're trying to get their perfect photo. They're not as interested in socializing. But when I was in Wisconsin, I felt like everyone was nice, as in like, oh, hey, how's it going? Let me help you cut your grass. And then when I moved to Louisiana, people were where I did my master's, people were also super nice, but it was like, hey, come in and try this gumbo I just made. So it was like two very welcoming places, but in slightly different ways. And then in some of those other places in California too, I felt like people were very weird about their land. We had to be extra careful that, we didn't even park on the road by somebody's property where they were going to get like upset. So it's interesting the different kind of cultures that you run into in the different places. And I feel like every state is just slightly different.
Yeah, I do feel like, yeah, there's some stereotypes. I also feel like all states, in some rural areas, you reach a point where people start to get more distrustful of strangers. Like it's a urban rural scale, but yeah, I honestly haven't done much birding outside of public land, so it's been pretty easy for me.
Gotcha. Do you have a favorite bird?
So I add qualifications to that. I have like a favorite nostalgic bird for me. I have a favorite scientific bird,
All right,
a
let's go
favorite
down the
like,
list then.
yeah. Okay. So my nostalgic bird is Eastern Bluebird. We had them nesting behind my house. My favorite bird song is the black-faced solitaire, if I'm remembering that right. But I heard those in Panama and I couldn't believe that that was actual bird song. It's beautiful. Most scientifically interesting bird for me, that's probably plover, western snowy plover, just because I got to see their behavior up close and it instantly made me question why they make the choices that they do. For example, I see them with their chicks, raising their young. And if a chick gets separated from its parent and it wanders into a different adult's territory, sometimes that adult will attack the chick or sometimes it will adopt the chick. And it makes me wonder what factors make that chick more likely to be adopted or attacked. Like what changed it? Because it's not obvious to us. It would be a cool thing to study, but difficult to get to. As for other favorites, my spark bird, I would say, is the common loon. I got to work with them pretty early on, and it was a great experience.
Tell me more about your work with the loons.
That was work that I got to join for just 1 week. In the summer of 2017 and 2018. So, not a long time thing, but we did breeding surveys in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. And those were all nocturnal surveys. So we took a canoe or kayak out onto the boat where we knew that a loon had chicks in this water. And we captured loons with spotlighting and with nets and took blood samples and measurements and attached bands if bands were not already attached to their legs. And I got to see, you know, a young loon chick, tiny little thing covered in down feathers. And it's a just gorgeous bird, you know.
Yeah. How did the netting work with that? Like, what kind of net did you guys use?
They're like big salmon nets, like 3 foot wide nets. One person at the front of the boat is spotlighting. So they shine the light onto the loon. And the light doesn't blind the loon, but it does kind of blind it from your approach and stun it somewhat. And it allows you to quietly get the boat to approach. And then usually the loon figures it out and dives. But hopefully at that point, you're close enough that someone with the net scoops the loon out of the water.
Interesting. I've never really heard about how people catch loons. Because, you know, just thinking about that, that seems like one of the more difficult birds to capture.
Oh, yeah. The team I was on, like 90% of our loons were caught by one guy who'd been doing it for decades, and everyone
Like,
knew where. Yeah.
What was his name?
Struggled. His name was Gary.
Yeah, like, get Gary down here. We need someone to catch this loon.
Yeah. It was like, Gary, you can't retire. No one else can do this very well.
Yeah, that reminded me of an experience I had on a barrier island where we were. I was helping film and helping with the crew banding royal terns. And it was the kind of thing where they had a nesting colony and they found the best way to catch them was literally just walking up slowly with a big net and just going over the top of them and catching them. And there was one of the girls who had done it before. And so she was the best at doing it. And then Eric, one of the scientists who was with us, he was determined to get one. He's like, I can't let them like best me. So eventually he got one too. But the things that people do to capture birds is interesting. Did you guys use the cannon nets when you were doing snowy plover stuff?
No, snowy plovers was actually the craziest bird capture I think I've been a part of, just because the whole method, for the chicks at least, for capturing the chicks, is run up and pick them up from the ground. Because you are mostly faster than them, but it's actually pretty even matched. So we all sprinted after some snowy plover chicks. And it's really about skill. You have to see that bird far before it sees you, know how to sneak up on it on a beach where there's no cover or, you know, vegetation, and time your approach perfectly. And it was very difficult. It was a steep learning curve. And as for the adults, those were captured using noose carpets. So, you know, like a slip knot, the bird steps into it and then it tightens around the ankle and keeps the bird from moving further.
Interesting. Yeah, that's one I've never seen in action. When I wanted to help with some red knot banding and they used the cannon nets that actually like, you know, load the explosives. And then they like when the flock comes in, they'll actually fire it out at it. That I think that was the most wild capture that I've seen, just because it's very precise and you have to make sure that nothing's going to go wrong with your pyrotechnics or anything.
Yeah, I've never done cannon netting, but I would love to see it. Seems dramatic.
It was very dramatic. What do you think your success rate was with catching the snowy plover chicks?
On a day where I was well rested and focused, maybe 60% success rate at most, but often it was more like 25, 15% success rate.
Gotcha. I picture that becoming like the bane of your existence. You're like, guys, I can't go out tonight. I got to be rested to catch these chicks in the morning.
Yeah, we've all face first fallen into the sand at some point chasing for birds.
Gotcha. With doing so much banding, what bird having in the hand do you appreciate a lot more after having that experience with it? Like maybe it was one you overlooked, but then you saw it up close and you're like, wow, this is actually way cooler than I thought it would be.
Every bird, for sure.
Or maybe one where you're like, this thing's actually kind of lame. I don't know why people like these.
Yeah. I mean, every bird you're holding, you're realizing that they're real things you can interact with. And I guess I already knew they were real, but it's different.
That's
you
news
know?
To some people.
Yeah. Birds aren't real. Government drones, for sure. Yeah. I already told you my anecdote about the wax wings, and they have the wax on the tips of the wings. That was
Yeah,
really cool.
it is
Yeah.
pretty neat. I guess two questions here. Is there one on your list that's next to see? Could be anywhere in the world. And then is there one on your list that you want to have in hand? Or maybe one that's kind of evaded you over the years?
Plenty of what I want to see, like all of the birds that are migrating into Oklahoma right now. I've never seen painted bunting, so really excited for
It's
that.
going to be a fun spring for you, I think.
Yes. I've chased them in the past and failed, so I'm waiting for them to come to me. A bird I would love to have in hand. I would love to do more work with raptors if possible. I have had the chance to hold a raptor. I held a red-tailed hawk that was it was removed because it was eating snowy plovers.
Oh.
And they relocated it, but I got to hold it briefly, and that was a scary, exciting feeling to hold a bird that big.
Yeah, that's cool. That's one I've never held. I have gotten to release a long-eared owl once, and that was neat. It was at a saw-whet owl banding, but sometimes they would get other owls. And so, like, we got this long-eared owl if anyone wants to release it. So I got to hold it, and I remember holding it, and it, like, tried to go down and, like, get me with its beak. And, like, so I was just holding on, but I wouldn't have had anything to do if it actually, like, struck. And that was a little unnerving having a, bigger bird like that kind of go after you. But it was a pretty cool
Oh, yeah.
experience.
It didn't get you, though. It was just
No, it just
faking.
tried. It just tried. But it was cool. With the red tail, was it like a, continuous problem that you were watching it eat the plovers and you're like, we got to do something about it?
Yeah. We, monitored those plovers 5 days a week, and we saw that same bird perched in the same spot every day, and we did record some predations. And yeah, we have a predator control team that would repeatedly capture and remove raptors, but it's somewhat of a moot cause at some point because a lot of raptors, they would drive 2 states away, they drive for like 12 hours, release the bird, come back. And the joke was that the bird would make it back before they did because they're so good at navigating.
Would they really come back all that way to the same spot?
In the case of the 2 years I worked, I don't think we saw it happen, but within the predator control world, it has happened several times.
That's crazy. I guess it's just that good of a hunting ground. My thought was that if, that bird's out, then some other predator might just come in and kind of take its place.
Yeah, that's possible. I do remember that they wanted to encourage ospreys to nest around the area because ospreys did not predate on plovers. They only ate fish, so.
Interesting. I would, because I would kind of think if one happened upon one, they would, but I guess they are pretty fish dominated with their diet, huh?
Yeah, I never saw them in the 2 years I was there. They never went for anything but fish. They did
What?
take our we had stakes to mark nests and sites, and they did take those stakes sometimes and put them in their nests, so that was frustrating.
That's kind of funny. I feel like they did it just to bother you guys. They're like, I saw somebody put this out. This would be good in the nest.
Yeah, they're like, thank you for this nice long stick. Couldn't
Yeah.
find any.
So in addition to kind of you mentioned the sometimes they would adopt the chicks going into the territory, what else did you learn about snowy plovers from observing them all that time?
They are semi-territorial, semi-colonial. So, they don't nest right next to each other, and they don't nest miles apart. They'll nest within 100 meters or so, and there are always exceptions to every rule. I learned that they always seem to anticipate the breeding season a little too soon, as in they get their breeding plumage in December, but really they don't start laying nests until April. So it seems like a lot of them get hormonal a little too early. Other things that I'm trying to think of things that I observed that maybe you couldn't get off Wikipedia or something. I learned that snowy plovers lay 3 eggs in their nest, but piping plovers lay 4.
Is that pretty consistent? Like every time you would see that same number? That's cool.
And piping plovers will do a display called goose stepping or goosenecking, and snowy plovers do not do that, as far as I know. And I switched. I worked for 2 years with snowy plovers, and then I did a year this past summer with piping plovers, and it was crazy to watch them do that display for the first time.
What does that look like exactly?
So the male will stand kind of behind the female and he'll stretch his neck as long as he can. And he'll kick his legs up straight in front of him, like he's a drum major in a marching band or something. And he does it rapidly. And if she likes it, they'll copulate.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever seen one do
Consider looking it up on YouTube because it's pretty
that.
funny.
Gotcha. That I feel like that must be pretty cool to just be able to observe kind of the same birds in the same area, you know, every day and see their behaviors. And did you like name any of them? Like, oh, it's Frank doing his display again.
Yes, for sure. I feel like the good biologist thing to do is to not name them and remain distant, but maybe I'm not a good biologist because
I've
I did
seen
name
plenty
them.
of published papers where like this is fat shark number five or whatever, and then Jim over there, and you know, so
Yeah.
I know researchers do that a lot.
Our birds somewhat came with names because we banded them with colored plastic bands. So then there was a letter combination to represent those bands on their legs. And sometimes they'd spell out fun names.
For the Wilson's plovers, it was like, oh, it's N9 or it's like L5 or you know, whatever it was.
Yeah. Ours could spell out some fun words. Like we had a bird. This was before I joined, but they had a bird that they banded with pink, orange, orange, and pink bands. And so it spelled out poop. And that was a fun joke for
That's
all of
tough.
everyone involved.
It's a tough life for that plover.
Poop had a tough life, and I don't think Poop lived very long.
Red-tailed hawk.
Probably,
Dang.
probably.
What advice would you have for people that want to get into the birding biology scene? Would you suggest that they kind of take the route you did of volunteering and then doing seasonal work and then maybe research, or would you encourage them to jump into research first, or what's your top tips for them?
Definitely depends on what they are interested in, what they want out of their career. And this is something I think about a lot, so stop me if I talk too much. But if someone just wants to handle and be close to wildlife, I would encourage them to go more towards animal rehab. And in that case, like contacting a rehab that's near their hometown. If they are interested more in like the scientific method and like research side of it, then that case, I would say they definitely need to start getting experience as soon as possible. And the best way to do that is to get a paid position, but this field is very competitive, and a lot of people will not have success applying for paid positions because you'll be competing with people who got experience through volunteering. I actually was paid for my first position, but that was a case where I had already networked with my this professor at my university. And I also did my time with volunteer positions, but those are somewhat problematic because people who are lower income can't really afford to do those volunteer positions. And so it reduces the diversity of our field. And that's something that I hope changes in the future. But for anyone interested, yes, if you can't afford it, look into volunteer positions. And there are job sites for that. The Texas A&M Job Board or Ornithology Exchange will both have good options on there.
Yeah, the Texas A&M job board is, I feel like for anyone in wildlife biology, that's kind of the main place people get directed. So it's basically just they have listings from different places and it's, you know, it could be mammal related field work. They have graduate positions, internships, I think, and also paid positions. So if you want a wide array of things to check out, I would highly recommend that one to anyone listening. And then you can also filter it by state or, you know, type of job it is. So yeah, that's a
Yep.
good suggestion for sure. What would be, after you're done, what would be your dream job?
Dream job. I am planning to go research all the way. So after my master's, I'm going to get a PhD is the plan. And then I want to design and conduct and publish research. I am not sure exactly what institution I want to do that in. I am considering the academic field. I'm also considering government. And nonprofit options would be the three sectors that are most open to me, or I guess private sector for environmental consulting work. But I am somewhat leaning towards either academia or nonprofit work. But yep, research
Gotcha.
all the way.
Would PhD, you think, be at Oklahoma State or maybe somewhere else?
I'm open to working at Oklahoma State, but I do like traveling somewhat, and I think that the timing and best position will most likely not be in the same institution that I'm at now.
Gotcha. We always kind of ask this with everybody. You being more new to birding might not have as much opinion on this, but when you've been out in the field, have you ever ran into anything paranormal or sketchy or, you know, Sasquatchy, maybe in California? Have any weird experiences with that?
You know, a lot of my work has been in somewhat urban environments, so it hasn't been so out there to have those kinds of experiences.
No
I certainly
Sasquatch
have
on the
been.
beach in California sunbathing or anything like that. He's
No,
eating
no.
our snowy plovers.
Yep, he's not out there if he is out there. Yeah, I did a little bit of remote work in those nocturnal surveys in the Adirondack Mountains. Certainly heard a lot of scary noises that I wasn't totally sure what they were, but probably just wildlife.
Gotcha. Anything else, you know, where you felt a little unnerved or kind of like a dangerous or sketchy situation? Not necessarily like Sasquatch or paranormal, but just kind of like anything like that?
Well, I did some field work in Panama, and that was somewhat dangerous due to venomous snakes. But my biggest fear were wasps, because all of my work was off trail, you know, pushing through vegetation and shrubs. And those were where wasps were nesting. And I worried about pushing a branch that had a wasp nest I didn't see on it, because it was so like lush and thick out there that I felt like it was very possible that I could grab a hornet's nest and not even know it and get stung. And it had happened to other crew members as well. I heard so many stories of people having to sprint to the ocean and dive in to avoid hornets and then losing all their gear. But thankfully, it did not happen to me.
Did you run into any venomous snakes out there?
I did see one coral snake out there, but it wasn't a scary experience. We were a good distance apart.
Yeah, I feel like they're pretty cute as far as venomous snakes go. Like, I'd rather run into seeing a coral snake than seeing like a coiled up cottonmouth or something like that. You
Oh,
know,
yeah.
depending on where you're at. But so there was one time when I was in Costa Rica, and it was with a school group. And so me and one of the guides were kind of in the back, so we were doing a bunch of birding, and there was another guide with the rest of our group that was up ahead of us. And so we'd kind of been in the back of the group, and we finally caught up to them, and they were all like in distress. And we were like, oh, what's going on? And they had all gotten stung by wasps that like came out of this one tree. I guess it kind of paid that we were birding and doing our own thing in the back, but we made sure that they were all right. And then somebody said that there was a common potu like up the road past where they got stung. So we ended up like draping a bunch of, you know, sweatshirts over us so we wouldn't get stung. And we went to go see the common potu. So we had a great time, but the rest of our group, not so much. But
That's
those
funny.
wasps, you know, those wasps are serious. You do not want to mess with those fellows.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We had warrior wasps out there, and those can be fatal, I've heard.
Yeah, we're doing field work in those South American countries. It seems really cool because of the fact that some of it's unexplored, but it also seems, you know, like there's a lot of unknown, probably dangers there. I always worry about, well, I hear about people going to Mexico, but I never know exactly how safe it is. I heard it depends kind of what area you're at. But anything outside of the US just feels relatively more dangerous, in my opinion.
Yeah, anywhere tropical, there's certainly, I don't know, I feel like there's always something to watch out for.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool. Anything else that you want to add about your birding journey or experience with field work or recommendations to anyone looking to get in the field?
I will just say that for anyone looking to get in the field, do your best to find a mentor. I think that you know, as a casual birder myself, I still love birding with other people who are better at identifying things and who know the right places to go. And that local information is so important for birding, especially if you want to see more than just, you know, your backyard birds. So, yeah, find a mentor.
Definitely. Well, is there a place people can check on your research, or should we wait for the publication?
You will have to wait for the official publication. If you want more constant updates, you can feel free to email me. I think you can find my LinkedIn by looking up my first and last name, and my email's on there.
Cool. Well, sounds good. Thanks so much for joining us, Maria.
Thank you for this opportunity. This was a first for me.
Yeah. And thanks to everyone for watching this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.